Oh, I almost forgot to start fading out there. I'm back again.
Part 4, War of Liberation. And the chapter is The Warlord at the Western Front. On May 10th, 1940, the Volkischer Beobachter, chief organ of the Nazi Party, rolled off the presses in Berlin, Munich, and Vienna with the Red Banner headlines. Germany's decisive struggle has begun. Man, I couldn't say that without fucking it up. And the Führer at the Western Front. After a half an hour's tough arguing, Keitel had persuaded Hitler to allow the OKW communique to end with the announcement that he himself had gone to the Western Front to take command. Hitler was loath to steal his general's thunder. His prestige was high. General Erwin Rommel, now commanding a panzer division in the West, had written a letter on April 21st. Yeah, if we didn't have the Führer, who knows whether any other German exists with such a genius for military leadership and such a commensurate mastery of political leadership, too. As a military commander, Adolf Hitler remained an enigma even to his closest associates. Alfred Jodl, perhaps his most able strategic advisor, was to write from a prison cell that he still asked himself whether he had really known the man at whose side he had led such a thorny and self-denying existence. I keep making the same mistake. I blame his humble origins, but then I remember how many peasants' sons were blessed by history with the name the Great. General Zietzler also grappled with this phenomenon, though more analytically. I witnessed Hitler in every conceivable circumstance, in times of fortune and misfortune, of victory and defeat, in good cheer and in angry outburst, during speeches and conferences, surrounded by thousands, by a mere handful or quite alone, speaking on the telephone, sitting in his bunker, in his car, in his plane, in brief, on every conceivable occasion. Even so, I can't claim to have seen into his soul or perceived what he was after. Zietzler saw him as an actor, with every word, gesture, and grimace under control, his penetrating stare practiced for hours, before some private mirror. He won over newcomers from the first handshake and piercing look, and paradoxically appeared the very embodiment of the strong and fearless leader, of honest and open heart. He cultivated the impression that he cared deeply for his subordinates' well-being. He would telephone a departing general at midnight, "Please don't fly, it's such foul weather and I'm worried about your safety." Or he would look a minor official in the eye and explain, "Now I'm telling you this privately, and you must keep it strictly under your hat." The surviving records are full of examples of the congenial impression Hitler made on others. Rommel proudly wrote on June 3rd, "The Führer's visit was fabulous. He greeted me with the words, 'Rommel, we were all so worried about you during the attack.'" Miltsch wrote down Hitler's words to him April 21st, 1941, after a particularly hazardous return flight from North Africa. "Thank goodness you got back." In June 1941, Albert Speer's Office Chronicle noted, "The Führer sent a telephone message from the Obersalzberg begging Herr Speer to drop the proposed visit to Norway, as things are too uncertain up there, and Herr Speer is indispensable to him." In February 1943, Field Marshal Wolfram von Richthofen wrote in his diary, "Finally, the Führer inquired very anxiously about my health." In mid-war, Hitler would halt urgent conferences with hungry generals for half an hour to allow his stenographers to eat. One wrote in his diary on February 20th, 1943, At the noon conference, the heater promised by the Führer is indeed there, a small China stove. In the afternoon, before a brief reception of seven officers hand-picked for special missions, for which the Führer briefs them in a short speech, he inquired on General Smoot's presence whether the stove was warm enough for us. When he said it was, he was hugely pleased and laughed out loud. His assessment of character was instant and deadly. A member of Jodl's staff, Captain Ivo Thilo von Trotha, wrote in 1946, "My impression was that the Führer clearly recognized the human weakness of his colleagues and stood aloof from them. Once he snatched a document from Keitel's hands and threw it on the floor. Keitel meekly gathered it up. Hitler judged newcomers after only a glance. Of one army commander, he sourly commented, he looks like a school teacher. And since for him every teacher was a Steistromler or buttock thrasher, that general's career was clearly at an end. Haller was to refer to his unusual intellect and grasp, his imaginativeness and willpower. Jodl wrote that in the French campaign, Hitler's leadership was clear, consistent, and capable. Jodl considered that in drafting the terms of the armistice with fallen France, Hitler showed a generosity that gave cause to hope that of the two warring impulses within him, it was the better that was gaining ground. In later campaigns, he asserted himself to the other extreme. The classical early Führer directive, in which his commanders were given a broad mission and left to their own discretion in carrying it out, was increasingly supplemented and supplanted by Führer orders, in which Hitler intervened in the tactical operations at every level. Hitler's headquarters for Yellow were at Munster Rifle. He found the underground command post here very cramped. Alone in his room, with its folding bed, table, and chair, he could hear every sound made by Keitel and Jodl next door. He preferred to hold his war conferences in the open air. He privately suggested to his staff that when the war was over, they should all return each year to Munster Rifle, my bird paradise. The site remained unchanged until 1944. It had been intended as a permanent memorial to Hitler's War of Liberation. As the Luftwaffe had predicted, May 10, 1940, dawned fine. Soon messengers brought him the exhilarating news that the British and French armies had begun pouring into Belgium. In October 1941, his armies now before Moscow, Hitler still remembered the thrill of that moment. I could have wept for joy. They'd fallen right into my trap. It was a crafty move on our part to strike toward Liège. We had to make them believe we were remaining faithful to the old Schlieffen plan. How exciting it will be later to go over those operations once again. Several times during the night, I used to go to the operations room to pore over those relief maps. The Belgians and Dutch were not unprepared, as one of Jodl's staff noted. Our troops were storming an enemy who was ready and waiting for our attack to begin early on May 10th. Ironically, it was Canaris's Abwehr that was appointed to find out how the enemy's suspicions had been aroused. The Abwehr adroitly diverted suspicion to a senior foreign ministry official. Extreme anxiety, reigned at Hitler's headquarters. One of Jodl's officers was accompanying the first wave of tanks invading Holland and Belgium with a radio truck, instructed to report directly to Hitler on the state of the bridges over the Meuse and the Albert Canal. The Dutch had evidently managed to blow up both bridges across the Meuse north and south of Maastricht. The Abwehr's Special Battalion 100, the Trojan Horse, had suffered fearful casualties, but the Belgian bridges across the Albert Canal, where 100 troops had silently landed in gliders as dawn broke, were intact, except for one at Cannes. By 4:30 p.m., Hitler learned that the 4th Panzer Division had actually forded the Meuse. At Ibn Emael, a band of intrepid German engineer troops armed with hollow-charge explosives had landed by glider and immobilized the entire fortress. The underground gun crews were sealed in. Their artillery was knocked out. By early next morning, May 11th, a temporary bridge had been thrown across the Meuse at Maastricht, and an armored brigade had crossed. Ibn Emael capitulated at midday, and with this, Belgium's fate was effectively sealed. In the north, a four-day battle raged as the Dutch tried to wipe out the paratroops and glider-borne infantry landed at Rotterdam and The Hague. Bomber squadrons had already taken off to relieve the pressure on the paratroops at Rotterdam on May 14th, when word arrived that the Dutch were capitulating. Only half the bombers could be recalled. The rest dropped nearly 100 tons of bombs on the town. 900 people died in the subsequent inferno. The next day, Holland formally surrendered. It was now time for Hitler's masterstroke. His main offensive was to start far to the south at Sedan, where General von Kleist's armor had just crossed the Meuse. On May 14th, Hitler directed the directed all available panzer and mechanized divisions were to assemble for a rapid push from this bridgehead westward and then northwestward to the English Channel. The course of the operation so far shows that the enemy has not perceived the basic idea of our own operation, the eventual breakthrough by Army Group A, that is Rundstedt's. They are still moving up powerful forces to a line extending from Antwerp to Namur, and apparently neglecting the sector confronting Army Group A. From this moment on, only a resolute commander supported by outstanding military intelligence could have saved France. General Gerd von Rundstedt is said to have remarked that he would have found it much more interesting to fight the rest of the campaign in the shoes of France's army, Chief of Staff General Maurice Gamelin. Again, as in the Norwegian campaign, Hitler's nerve briefly left him. When Brauchitsch made his irregular twice daily telephone call, Hitler bombarded him about a minutia of which the army's thorough preparations had long taken care. As Kleist's armor swept onward toward the Channel coast on May 17th, Hitler intervened to order that they halt to allow the slower infantry divisions time to catch up. Halder's intelligence branch, Foreign Armies West, had consistently estimated that half the Anglo-French forces were in the north, waiting to be cut off. Victory euphoria gripped Berlin. Goebbels wrote privately on the 19th, "Since 1938, we have conquered 7 European countries." Hitler, however, was fearful of overreaching himself. He drove to Rundstedt's headquarters, nervously studied the tactical maps, and on his return to his own headquarters, spread a wholly unnecessary gloom about the danger from the south. When Halder and Brauchitsch saw him the next day, he was raging that the army was needlessly running the risk of defeat. Not until May 20th was the crisis over. The army reported that there were at least 20 enemy divisions trapped north of the Somme. In the evening, when Brauchitsch telephoned Hitler with the news that the tanks had reached the Channel coast, Hitler was ecstatic with praise for the army and its commanders. His health mirrored these euphoric victories. Personal physician Morel wrote on May 26th, "Asked the Führer a few days back if he's got any complaints. He said he feels fine apart from one thing. He still has an appetite that's far too large. He really is getting along famously." According to Jodl, the Führer spoke of the peace treaty he would now make with France. He would demand the return of all the territories and properties robbed from the German people these last 400 years, and he would repay the French for the ignominious terms inflicted on Germany in 1918 by conducting the first peace negotiations at the same spot in the forest of Compiègne. Hitler jubilantly predicted that this victory would right the wrongs done by the Peace of Westphalia, which had concluded the 30 Years' War and established France as the dominant power in Europe. It was this victory psychosis prematurely sprung upon his military staff that was to prove his undoing at Dunkirk. For a while, Hitler turned his attention to long-range planning. He was not keen to fight the British Empire, not because he feared the outcome, but because he liked the English. While freely defaming Churchill and his ministers as war criminals, he often spoke to his private staff and to Dr. Goebbels, certainly no Anglophile himself, of this fondness for the British. "The Führer's intention," Goebbels had recorded on April 21st, "is to administer one knockout punch. Even so, he would be ready to make peace today on condition that Britain stay out of Europe and give us back our colonies. He does not want at all to crush Britain or to destroy her empire." They, that is the British, could have had peace on the most agreeable of terms. The Führer sighed a few days later to Goebbels, "Instead, they are fighting a war and shattering their empire to the core." And he added some days after that, on May 7th, "We are neither able nor willing to take over their empire. There are some people whom you can talk sense into only after you've knocked out their front teeth." And then you become best friends, right? The second phase of the campaign faced him, therefore, with something of a dilemma. On May 20th, he already conferred about this with Brauchitsch and Halder. His earlier eagerness for Italian divisions to join in an offensive on the Upper Rhine front had evaporated. He wrote to Mussolini with word of his latest victories, but Mussolini's replies were an uninspiring amalgam of polite applause and qualified promises of later belligerency. Indeed, an awkward disparity of aims was now emerging. For Italy, the main enemy was now Britain, while Hitler hoped and believed that he could oblige Britain to come to terms with him. When Jodl, a few days later, suggested that an immediate invasion of England be prepared, the Führer roundly rejected the idea without explaining why. We must conclude that he believed that the blockade by submarine and bomber operations would force Britain to submit, for he indicated that after France's defeat, he would concentrate on the production of submarines and Junkers 88 bombers. The ever-present Russian threat to Germany was still a distant one. From the slow rate at which the airfield construction was progressing in the Russian-occupied border regions, it seemed clear that Germany still had breathing space, during which the Kremlin would continue to appease Hitler. Molotov had expressed Russia's genuine relief that Germany had managed to invade Norway before the Allies had, and he had received word of Yellow with equal sympathy. But this honeymoon would not last any longer than served the Russian purpose. How else is one to interpret the Führer's cryptic remark to Halder on April 24, 1940? We have an interest in seeing to it that the Romanian oil fields keep supplying us until next spring at the least. After that, we shall be freer. Romania was now exporting over 130,000 tons of oil a month to Germany. Nothing must endanger these oil fields. A Balkan quagmire, Hitler's nightmare. At the end of May, the risk became acute as rumors multiplied of Italian plans to attack Yugoslavia. This would free Hungary to attack Romania, and Russia would use this as a pretext to invade Romania as well. On May 20th, the German military attaché in Moscow quoted to Berlin reliable details of Soviet troop concentrations on the Romanian frontier. Molotov denied them, but the facts spoke for themselves. Brauchitsch urged Hitler on the 22nd to do something to curb these Russian ambitions. Hitler responded that he hoped to limit the Russian expansion to Bessarabia. Wiesacker wrote a curious passage in his private diary on May 23rd. Assuming there is a crushing victory in the West, the obvious next move would be to create order in the East as well. That will give us breathing space and river frontiers, an order that will endure. Whether Britain submits at once or has to be bombed into her senses, the fact is there will probably have to be one more squaring of accounts in the East. Nothing yet indicated that London might already have decided to evacuate northern France. On the contrary, Hitler was convinced the British would fight to the last round. On May 21st, there was a minor crisis when British and French tanks sprang an unexpected attack on the inner flank of the German Fourth Army at Arras. Both Hitler and Rundstedt took this as a warning that the armored spearhead of Army Group A had advanced too fast, and Rundstedt ordered the Fourth Army and Kleist Armored Group to delay their advance on the Channel ports until the crisis was resolved. Brauchitsch and Halder regretted Rundstedt's overcautious conduct of the operations of Army Group A, bearing up on the Channel ports from the southwest, and without informing Hitler, they ordered control of the Fourth Army transferred to General von Bock's Army Group B, which was advancing on the ports from the east. Bock was to command the last act of the encirclement. Hitler learned of this when he visited Rundstedt's headquarters at Charleville the next morning, May 24th. The Fourth Army was ordered for the time being to stay where it was. It was tactically foolhardy, claimed Hitler, to commit tanks in the swampy Flanders lowlands to which the War Department would have sent them. The previous day, the Fourth Army's General Gunter Hans von Kluge had himself persuaded Rundstedt that it would be better to allow Kleist's armor time to regroup for a more methodical assault on the 25th. Rundstedt's proposal stated to Hitler on May 24th went one stage further. His armor should remain where it was and give an appropriate welcome to the enemy forces swept westward by Bock's Army Group B. This pause would give the tanks a valuable respite. There was a political element, too, in this controversial decision. Hitler desired to spare Belgium's relatively friendly Flemish population, the destruction of property this closing act of Yellow would entail. At all events, Hitler did not hesitate to lend his authority to Rundstedt's decision to rein in the tanks. At 12:30, the Führer's headquarters telephoned the halt order. The tanks were to stand fast west of the canal line.
there could be no talk of his going soft on the British, because that same day, in a directive giving guidelines for the further campaign against Britain, Hitler merely indicated in passing that the Luftwaffe's present job in the north was to break all resistance of the encircled enemy and prevent any British forces from escaping across the channel. Thus the tanks remained rooted to the spot. As Halder bitterly commented in his diary, Hitler refused to set the tanks in motion. One more factor had arisen. On the evening of the 25th, he explained to his adjutants that he particularly wanted the SS Elite Brigade under Sepp Dietrich to join in this crucial action at Dunkirk. His intention was to show the world that he had troops equal to the best that even a racially advanced nation as Britain could field against him. By May 26th, Sepp Dietrich's Liebstandarte, By May 26th, Sepp Dietrich's Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler was in position. On that morning, too, Rundstedt's staff changed their attitude, since radio monitoring suggested that their appreciation of enemy intentions was wrong. The British seemed to be pulling out. Halder's Foreign Armies, West Branch, had certainly reported, as early as May 21st, that the unusual number of troops transports seen in Dunkirk and Boulogne, might indicate that British troops were about to be evacuated, and the permanent radio link between the War Office in London and the BEF in France, first monitored the next day, also suggested that events were being removed from French control. On May 26th, at 1:30 p.m., Hitler told Brauchitsch that the tanks might resume their eastward drive at once. They were to get within artillery range of Dunkirk, and the army's heavy artillery and the Luftwaffe would do the rest. From the air, the Luftwaffe could see that the British were embarking only their troops, abandoning all their equipment as they fled. The beaches were thick with waiting Englishmen. The roads were choked with truck columns 15 miles long. Goering boasted of the carnage his bombers were wreaking in Dunkirk harbor. Only fishing boats are getting through. Let's hope the Tommies can swim. The reality, however, was different. The Luftwaffe bombers were largely based on airfields back in Germany, and either their bombs were ineffective against small ships, or they exploded harmlessly in the sand dunes, more ominously, the German bombers proved no match for the short-range British fighters. The Germans found that for the first time, the enemy had local air superiority, and their troubles were added to by the fact that at the end of May, the Luftwaffe's 8th Air Corps was grounded by fog for 3 days. Oh, bummer. While these momentous events were transpiring in the West, in Germany's new eastern domains, a ruthless program of subjugation and pacification had begun. On Sunday, May 25th, the Reichsfuhrer SS outlined to Hitler and the head of his chancellery, Hans Lammers, proposals for dealing with the various racial strains in Poland. Himmler handed the Führer his 6-page plan for screening the population of these new dominions for adults and children of sufficiently pure blood to allow their assimilation into Germany. He proposed that all other children should be taught only necessary rudiments, simple counting up to 500, how to write their names, and lessons on the divine commandment to obey the Germans and be honest, industrious, and well-behaved. Racially acceptable children could be evacuated to the Reich to receive a proper education. As Himmler pointed out, however cruel and tragic each individual case may be, this method is still the mildest and best if we are to reject as un-Germanic, impossible, and incompatible with our convictions the Bolshevik method of physically exterminating a race. After a few years of this racial sifting, he said, a low-grade potpourri of races would remain in the East. This population will be available to Germany as a leaderless labor force. They themselves will eat and live better than under Polish rule, and given their own lack of culture, they will be well appointed to work under the strict, forthright, and just leadership of the German nation on its eternal cultural mission. As for the Jews, Himmler's plan disclosed, I hope to effect the complete disappearance of the Jew from Europe by means of a mass emigration of all Jews to Africa or some other such colony. Afterward, Himmler scribbled in his notebook, Memorandum on Poland. Führer warmly approves. A month later, Himmler took the opportunity of a train journey with Hitler to show him an 8-page plan for settling these eastern provinces with strong German stock. Himmler proposed that young, unmarried German soldiers be induced to settle and work the land in the eastern provinces for up to 8 years before marrying and taking over a farmstead or estate. The foreign laborers were to be kept in serfdom. Attempts at sexual relations with their German overlords would be punishable by death. He afterward noted on the document, the Führer said every point I made was right. By June 2, 1940, the British evacuation of Dunkirk was over. German army intelligence estimated that half the enemy forces had been swept from the battlefield. Brauchitsch telephoned this information to Hitler that evening. The German army, with 136 divisions, was virtually intact. It would embark on the final defeat of France with a 2-to-1 superiority. Hitler's blueprint for this operation was largely determined by short-term political factors. Verdun must be captured as rapidly as possible. Overland contact must be made with Spain. Paris itself would be bypassed to the east and west, for Hitler feared nothing more than that an 1871-style communist uprising in the capital might bring his forces into armed conflict with Soviet-backed communists. The Maginot Line would be taken from the rear. This second phase would begin at 5 a.m. on June 5th. Meanwhile, surrounded by party officials and personal bodyguards, Hitler toured the battlefields in northern France and Flanders. Morel, who accompanied him, reported, "We were on the road for 2 days. Brussels, the Flanders battlefields, Ypres, Loretto, Vimy Ridge, and Bensheim, Courtrai, and Lille, as these areas were about the most densely populated on Earth, you can just imagine the devastation. A big square in Lille, piled high with charred tree trunks and automobiles, was littered with dead horses, burned-out tanks, and buildings. On the roads along which the British and French retreated, there was a higgledy-piggledy tangle of cast-off clothing, abandoned guns and broken-down tanks, with stragglers streaming back home on both sides of the road, mostly on bicycles, laden with whatever they can carry." At Brussels, where Bock had assembled his senior generals, Hitler explained, "Gentlemen, you will have wondered why I stopped the armored divisions outside Dunkirk. The fact was I could not afford to waste military effort. I was anxious lest the enemy launch an offensive from the Somme and wipe out the Fourth Army's weak armored force, perhaps even going so far as Dunkirk. Such a military rebuff, as he put it, might have had intolerable effects on foreign policy." At Charleville the next day, June 2nd, he addressed Rundstedt and his generals. He outlined the new operation to them and informed them that Italy would shortly join in. He spoke of the reparations he proposed to exact from France. Once again, he extolled Britain her mission for the white race. It was not, he said, a matter of inconsequence to him, which power ruled India. One general wrote in his diary, "He points out that without a navy the equal of Britain's, we could not hold on to her colonies for long. Thus we can easily find a basis for peace agreement with Britain. France, on the other hand, must be stamped into the ground. She must pay the bill." As he left the villa, crowds of cheering soldiers thronged his car. Hitler, every inch the warlord, acknowledged their acclaim. To Hitler, the war seemed already won. He said as much to Admiral Canaris on June 3rd, when the intelligence chief came to report on the Abwehr agents who had been killed in the campaign so far, and he repeated it to Admiral Raeder the next day. Hitler's occupation policy in Holland and Belgium was to establish these Germanic states as border dependencies around a mighty German core. As early as November, he had drafted a decree on the administration of the countries which were to be occupied in yellow. In the version he had signed on May 9th, he had deleted the words, "There is to be no exploitation of the occupied regions in a selfish German interest." In Holland, as in Norway, he appointed a Reich Commissar to fill the vacuum left by the fleeing monarchy. He chose an Austrian, Arthur Seyss Inquart, evidently on Himmler's recommendation. Since Belgium had fought honorably and capitulated unconditionally, Hitler was inclined to leniency.
he agreed to Goering's heartfelt request that King Leopold be chivalrously treated. A senior statesman, Otto Meissner, was sent to tell the king that if Belgium now acted sensibly, his kingdom might yet survive. Otherwise, Hitler would create a new Gaul, Flanders. A telegram in German army files indicate that King Leopold was furious at the looting and willful destruction of his country by the withdrawing French and British troops. So Hitler's political wisdom in ordering his armies to spare the cities of Flanders from unnecessary visitations undoubtedly paid dividends. Here, too, Hitler appointed a German military governor, General Alexander von Falkenhausen, as a liberal commander and maintained Falkenhausen was a liberal commander and maintained liaison with the king. There was, in consequence, little resistance to the Nazi presence in Belgium. Hitler retrieved for Germany the former German areas of Eupen, Malmedy, and Moresnet, which had been annexed by Belgium in 1918. He ordered Brauchitsch to separate the Belgian prisoners of war into Flemings and Walloons. The former 200,000 men of trusty Germanic stock were to be released forthwith, while the latter 150,000 less friendly prisoners were to be held in continued pawn. For the second half of the French campaign, Hitler's staff had found a new headquarters site in southern Belgium, in the deserted village of Brully-de-Pesche, in a forest clearing. The whole headquarters, codenamed Forest Meadow, was ready with its anti-aircraft batteries and barbed wire entanglements by the time Hitler arrived on June 6th. He never felt as secure here as he did at Munsterifel. Perhaps it was the swarms of mosquitoes that rose from the dense undergrowth to plague him, or perhaps it was the general impatience to end the war. Brauchitsch often visited in person. Hitler had mellowed toward him, and seems to have taken him more into his confidence about his future military plans. For a while, Hitler abandoned his idea of discarding Brauchitsch. He could hardly do this to the commander-in-chief of a victorious army, as he mentioned to one adjutant. A member of the headquarters staff wrote of these weeks of waiting for the French collapse. Every evening, the Führer ate privately with 10 or 12 others. I remember we all debated the reason why the cuckoo makes a point of laying its eggs in other birds' nests. One of Hitler's secretaries wrote on June 13th, "For a week now, we have been out front again in a deserted village. Every night we get the same performance. At precisely 12:20, enemy aircraft come and circle over the village. If they don't come then," the chief, meaning Hitler, inquires, Where is our airman on duty today, then? At any rate, every night finds us standing until 3:30 or 4 in the morning with the chief and other members of his staff in the open air watching the nocturnal aerial maneuvers until the reconnaissance planes vanish with the onset of dawn. The landscape at the hour of the morning reminds me of a painting by Caspar David Friedrich. On June 10, 1940, Italy formally declared war on Britain and France. Hitler made no attempt to disguise his contempt and forbade staff talks with the Italian forces. A member of Keitel's staff noted, "The Führer's view is that since Italy left us in the lurch last autumn, we are under no obligation to her now." In the foreign ministry, sardonic comparisons were drawn between Mussolini and the traditional circus clown who rolled up the mats after the acrobats completed their performance and demanded that the audience applaud him. Or again, the Italians were dubbed the harvest hands. There survives among the papers of Walter Huell, the German government's communique announcing Italy's inauspicious action, with eloquent amendments written in Hitler's own hand, where the original text proclaimed, "German and Italian soldiers will now march shoulder to shoulder and not rest until Britain and France have been beaten." Hitler irritably crossed out Britain, and then redrafted the latter part to read, "And I will fight on until those in power in Britain and France are prepared to respect the rights of our two peoples to exist." At the last meeting of the Supreme War Council held in France, Winston Churchill, the new British Prime Minister, begged the French to tie down the German forces by defending Paris. His appeal for yet more French blood to be spilled in Britain's cause may have rung cynically in his allies' ears. The French commanders left him in no doubt that for them the war was lost. The next day, June 13th, one of Hitler's secretaries wrote, "I personally cannot believe the war will go on after June. Yesterday there was a war council in Paris. Weygand declared the battle for Paris lost and suggested a separate peace, in which Pétain supported him, but Renaud and some other members thundered their protests against him. The French cabinet resigned, and the aged Marshal Henri Philippe Pétain, veteran and hero of World War I, took over. Pétain desired an armistice and wanted to know the German terms." One of Jodl's staff later wrote, "When he heard this news, Hitler was so delighted that he made a little hop. I had never seen him unbend like that before. He decided to meet Mussolini to discuss the terms at once. Meanwhile, the Wehrmacht was ordered to take Cherbourg and Brest as a matter of honor, and to occupy the Alsace and particularly Strasbourg as a matter of political geography. For many days, Hitler deliberated on the nature of the armistice itself. He would invite the French to undergo the same indignities they had visited on the defeated German generals in 1918 at Compiègne. It had been a... Compiègne? I don't know how it's... French, give me a break. It had been raining in 1918, and the Germans had been, or is it? I don't know. It might be true. The Germans had been kept waiting in the downpour to humiliate them. Then, however, he softened. Hitler wanted to show the British how magnanimous he could be in victory. At Munich, he persuaded Mussolini to shelve Italian territorial claims until a final peace treaty. Only northern France and the Atlantic coast down to the Spanish frontier would be occupied by the Germans. The rest would remain under Pétain's control. When Admiral Raeder asked him on the 20th if Germany could claim the fleet, Hitler replied that the German navy had no entitlement to the ships as the French fleet was unbeaten. The armistice therefore formally renounced all claim to the French fleet. The French might retain part to preserve their colonial interests. The rest was to be taken out of commission. Otherwise, the ships would be left unmolested. In fact, Hitler wished for nothing better than that they might be scuttled by their crews. At noon on June 22nd, Hitler drove through the fog-shrouded roads of northern France to the forest of Compiègne. The old wooden dining car in which Marshal Foch had dictated his terms to the Germans on November 11th, 1918, had been retrieved from its permanent display at Rotondus and set up in the same spot in the forest. 40 minutes later, the French arrived. Hitler sat at the long table in the dining car while General Keitel read out the preamble. Hitler himself had composed these words: "After a heroic resistance, France has been vanquished. Therefore, Germany does not intend to give the armistice terms or negotiations the character of an abuse of such a gallant enemy." After this 12-minute introduction, Hitler left while Keitel continued to dictate the terms. The railway coach would afterward be shipped to Berlin as an exhibit. The French memorial at Compiègne was demolished with explosives. Only the statue of Marshal Foch himself remained untouched on Hitler's instructions. He could now fulfill a lifelong dream to visit Paris and see its architecture. He sent for his three favorite intellectuals, the architects Speer and Giesler and the sculptor Arno Brecker, and they arrived at Brully-de-Pêche that evening, June 22nd. At 4 a.m. the next morning, they flew secretly to Le Bourget Airport. Here, at last, were the monuments so familiar to him from his encyclopedias. He was actually inside the Baroque Opera, asking the gray-haired usher to show him long-forgotten chambers of whose existence he was aware of from the architectural plans. For 3 hours shortly after dawn, he wandered around the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, and the Les Invalides, where he doffed his cap in awe of Napoleon's sarcophagus. When it was light enough, he gazed out across the city from the forecourt of Sacré-Cœur and Montmartre, whatever. At 10 that morning, he flew back to Belgium. That evening, he commanded Speer to draft a decree for the reconstruction of Berlin. It must outshine everything he had seen in Paris. An hour after midnight on June 25th, 1940, a burglar of the 1st Guards Company took up station at each corner of the Führer's village headquarters. Seated at the bare wooden table in his requisitioned cottage, Hitler awaited with Speer, his adjutants, and his secretaries. Throughout Europe, millions of radios were tuned in to this quiet forest acre. He ordered the lights in the dining room switched off, and the window opened. A radio turned low whispered a commentary. At 1:35 a.m., the moment prescribed for the armistice to take effect, the burglars sounded the ceasefire. The buglers, not burglars. God damn it. It was the most moving moment of his life. For four years, he had once fought as an anonymous infantryman, and now, as supreme commander, it had been granted to him to lead his people to a unique victory. After a while, he broke the silence. "The burden of responsibility," he began. But he could not go on, and asked for the lights to be turned on again. That's the end of the chapter, and I will see you again soon. Hope you guys enjoyed.